powered by RootslandNation.com. We're your culture.
Yes, my Rootsland family. Once again, I want to represent for our sponsor, SunsetLakeCBD.com. You know, one of my favorite quotes about cannabis was told to me by my friend Bob Andy, who I talk about a lot in the show. And he gives credit to Muta Baruka, the dub poet, for saying it. Muta Baruka said that he loves ganja so much that he can't smoke it because he can't bear to see it burn. It's true. If you ever notice, it's a beautiful plant. And if you love cannabis as much as Muta Baruka, then you need to order some of that Sunset Lake sun-dried hemp bud. It's so beautiful, you may not want to smoke it either. You may just want to put it in a glass jar, put it on one of your shelves and backlight it and just look at it. And you can even give your pet some of their pet CBD. And you can both stare at it. Remember, it's grown without any pesticides or herbicides. Legal in all 50 states and shipped right from their Vermont farm to your front door. So you get the best price as possible. Plus another 20% off when you use Rootsland in the code. And like I keep telling you, they're a socially conscious company owned by the farmers that grow the hemp. So check out SunsetLakeCBD.com. Farmer owned, Vermont grown, tasty, tangy hemp buds. Can't beat it. And make sure you check out all their high quality CBD and cannabis products.
Guys, righteous with Governor.
The Rootsland Podcast. Stories that are music to your ears.
What time is the flight?
I think a little bit after 2. Like 2:20.
You have enough time to stop 2:15. And get some jelly.
Oh, heck yeah. Coconut water?
Yeah, man. Coconut water.
Yeah, pull on over. Love to hydrate before the flight. Some natural electrolytes. Come on.
Yo, Henry, I rate Sizzla.
Who? Sizzla? Kalungi?
The DJ.
Yeah, I rate him. Especially his early stuff.
Well, him first bust onto the scene, you know. Black woman and child and him sang there. You know, get the people look up to him like he was a god. Right, Paul? Yeah, man. The murder Sizzla record it. Tough.
Yeah, that was really good stuff. Tumbled off a little bit since. Norman Manley International Airport sits on a narrow peninsula that stretches into the middle of Kingston Harbor, halfway between the community of Harborview and what remains of the old sunken pirate city Port Royal. With gusty Caribbean trade winds and the wreckage of long-defunct cargo planes littering the nearby coast, Kingston's Norman Manley Airport is definitely not one of the preferred routes for airline pilots. And to be honest, I was never crazy about it either. As we drove down the Palisados, a stretch of highway that connects Kingston proper with Port Royal, the twins ride with the windows open, and Sizzla Kalungi blasting from their CD player. As far as they were concerned, Miguel Orlando Collins, PKA Sizzla, was their generation's Bob Marley, one of the few voices willing to speak up for the poor and disenfranchised youth of Kingston. Sizzla exploded on the scene in the mid-90s. His 1997 groundbreaking dancehall album, Black Woman and Child, produced by Bobby Digital Dixon, forever changed the genre. A musically dense and lyrically profound record that blurred an already fuzzy line between reggae and dancehall. Although Sizzla's delivery was more of a rapper, DJ style than a singer, he learned to stretch his notes and bend his voice with just enough melody to make his music as catchy as it was revolutionary. A devout member of the Bobo Ashanti sect of Rastafari, his songs preached values consistent with ancient biblical and African scripture. Yet having grown up in Augusttown during the dark days of political violence, he spoke with the raw, unfiltered language of the streets and tenement yards. The kind of language that connected to ghetto youth, like the twins, Patrick and Paul Gaynor. You see, to this dancehall generation, who had been raised in an age of slackness, whose priorities were all too focused on material possessions, Sizzla Kalungi showed that ghetto people could be militant and rebellious, relevant and successful, without having to sell out and sing about sex and drugs and guns and bling. He showed that consciousness and righteousness also had its rewards. And over on Ricketts Avenue in Kingston 13, no one took more notice than a young curly locks gainer. This part of the drive always brings back memories. Gazing over the harbor, surveying all of Kingston, from the downtown corporate area to the lavish estates high in the hills overlooking the city. The same hills where I once lived. These days, things were more emotional than usual. We were all concerned with our friend Biggest Star. He left the island earlier in the week in pretty rough condition. Exhausted, dehydrated, dejected. He really didn't want to go until he finished the project. But we all thought he should see his doctor up in Florida before things got worse. Now I was flying up to hear the prognosis, and judging by the sound of Biggest voice on our last call, things weren't good. Just before reaching the airport, we pulled over for some fresh coconut water. There was an old-time jelly man who had a roadside stall not far from the water's edge, set up alongside his pickup truck, whose cargo bed was overloaded with a haul of fresh coconuts from country. It was so heavy you could barely see his tires. The waves crashed against the stone and concrete jetties that were designed to protect the airport road from flooding. Today they seemed to be working. The air was damp and tasted like salt water. I leaned against the Ford Taurus, sipping my coconut from a straw, thinking about Bigga, the trip to Kingston, problems we were having with the record company. Everything seemed so fragile and uncertain. I glanced over at the twins, who by now were in deep conversation with the jellyman, and a few other customers who had pulled over for some fresh coconut water. It's amazing. The twins never run out of things to say. Every night after the session at the studio, I would walk them back to the car, give Curly a small payment for gas and food, just as a way of saying thank you. I explained to Curly Locks that first night at the studio that there was no money in the budget for a songwriter or a vocal coach. It was something we just didn't even think of. And since the label wouldn't give us any additional funds, we couldn't afford to pay him any upfront money for his help. I did promise Curly that I would make sure he received all his proper songwriting and publishing credit. And if Biggest Star took off, well, we'd all go along for the ride. Now, I've been in the game long enough to know when you say those words, no upfront money, most people make a mad dash for the door. But lucky for me, Curly Locks wasn't most people. He was a chess player. Thinking so far ahead, he was already on to the next game. He graciously accepted whatever funds I could offer at the time, shared it with his brother Tulocks, never complained, never asked for more, always came with his A-game. But before heading back into the underbelly of the city, the Chisholm Avenue garrison that the siblings called home, Curly would lean out of his window, have one request. He'd ask one small favor.
Listen, Enrique.
Yes, Patrick.
We know you're down in Jamaica right now working with Biggest Star at Universal Records.
Okay, yeah.
I know that company from when I was a youth. The big globe in a space with it with the name Universal are spinning around it.
Oh, yeah. That's an iconic logo, the Universal logo.
But when the project finish and you have a few minutes, I would really like for you to take a listen to what Twin of Twins are all about.
I told you anytime. Oh, I'm dying to hear what Twin of Twins are all about.
Seeing? It's a thing named Stir It Up. You know, that I did from in the 90s.
Stir It Up, like the Bob Marley song?
Yeah, man.
Cool name.
It's basically my own genre. I call it gangster comedy.
Gangster comedy. That's actually pretty, that's bad. I like that.
Believe me, bro. There is nothing out there like it.
Yeah, that's original. I like that.
Do you know Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy? Those are the kind of people that influence me.
Richard Pryor? I love Richard Pryor. I used to have that videotape with him in the orange suit live on the Sunset Strip. Oh, my God.
With him in the orange suit and the black shirt.
Exactly, yeah, the black shirt.
Yeah, man. Richard Pryor is the boss.
I can't believe my mom let me watch that.
So before you leave yard, I'm going to give you a copy of our CD.
I'm in. Listen, Patrick.
Or whatever you can do in terms of links up in America.
Patrick.
Are any people you think, you know, may be interested in promoting our things up there?
Curly Locks, I told you. You did some amazing writing. You just made this trip for Bigga, okay? So, I'm in. I don't even have to hear the CD. I know what you're capable of. I'm in, all right? Give me the CD when I leave and whatever I can do, whatever doors I can open.
Whatever you can do, man.
You've really proved yourself, okay?
If we get the right break, Twin of Twins are gone. I'm telling you that. Nothing will hold us back.
When we pulled up to the terminal, Tulox popped the trunk. I took out my backpack and a small carry-on. I always like to travel light. No checked bags. I leaned through the open window on the passenger side, reached in and gave both twins fist bumps. Before stepping away, Curly handed me a CD. The CD. The one I had heard so much about.
Stir It Up Volume 4.
Twin of Twins, Stir It Up Volume 4. So this is it. Okay, I can't wait to listen. Hear what all your hype is about?
Yes, Enrique, I can know what you think. I respect your opinion. See?
But just one thing, guys, you know. When I get up, customs is going to ask if I got any packages from any strange individuals to carry up. And, you know, you guys definitely qualify as strange individuals, so I may have to, you know, let them know.
Bumbuckler fool, let that man fight. Let that man be idiot in Henry. What is that, brother?
Hey, I thought you guys are supposed to have a sense of humor.
Not true, man. We lose half of Henry. Give you back with CD.
Oh, no way. CD's mine.
All right, man. You all right. Trip. I yell up bigger for me.
Will do. All right, guys.
Respect.
After passing through security at the airport, I sat in the boarding area and pulled out the CD that Curly handed me earlier. I stared at the title, Stir It Up, written hastily in black marker. I thought about how many demo tapes and CDs I handed out, mailed out, dropped off over the years, and then anxiously awaited a callback, hoping for some kind of reply, even a no. I remember those days of constantly checking my phone, making sure the ringer was on, and that I had signal, as to not miss my big break when it came. As if someone's phone call going to voicemail would be the difference between a deal or no deal. That last week in Jamaica, while Bigga was undergoing his medical tests up in Florida, I spent most of the time driving around with Twin of Twins during the day, and on patrol with my friend Harris during the night, reminiscing and reconnecting with Kingston City. The twins took me on a tour of the ghetto where they grew up, Ricketts Avenue in Kingston 13, a place called Chisholm, where Patrick and Paul Gaynor had become local celebrities, complete with a full wall mural painted of them on one of Chisholm's high-profile street corners. Once in Chisholm, we made the rounds, and they introduced me to their mother, Miss Lou, matriarch of the Gaynor clan, who traveled to Kingston from Countryside as a teenager, with three kids, no money, no job or plan, hoping to find a better life and more opportunity in the city. With no place to stay, and second-guessing her choice, Miss Lou spent that night huddled with her children sleeping at a bus stop, when a concerned woman named Miss Birdie noticed the young mother and her children. The kind stranger felt something was out of place, feared this naive, light-skinned country girl would be in danger, exposed on the Kingston streets. So Miss Birdie agreed to take in the homeless mother, her young twins and their older brother, Deli, allowed them to stay at her house until they could find some footing and manage a place of their own. Miss Lou, in turn, never forgot that kindness, became the grand dame of Chisholm. Her house on Ricketts Avenue in the heart of the ghetto was a gathering place, a sanctuary in the war zone, where anyone that needed food, clothing, shelter, was always welcome. Speaking of family introductions, I also had the pleasure of spending a couple of days in Waterhouse, a gritty slum in West Kingston that I was first introduced to by Bob Andy when we came down to check a young vocal trio, The Bibles, my first time in Kingston. However, this visit was not by choice, but a necessary pit stop when the twins' Ford Taurus suddenly developed a mysterious engine noise that needed urgent attention from Mikey the mechanic, who incidentally was also their father. And by the way, when I say urgent attention, that means 10 hours, 6 patties, and 4 red stripes later. And not that I'm disparaging their dad Mikey the mechanic's mechanical proficiency, but to me the engine sounded exactly the same when we left as it had when we got there, on both days. Of course, no grand tour would be complete without an excursion through one of Kingston's harshest and most dystopian inner-city schemes, Painland, an area that lives up to its name. Warring factions from Payne Avenue, Mongoose Town, McCoy Lane, Tiger Valley, and Brownsland engage in a never-ending turf war to control a small patch of scorched ghetto earth, pothole-filled roads and crumbling concrete structures. Painland is also where two of the twins' closest childhood friends reside. Mitchie Terrible, an aspiring DJ who would have loved to be a recording artist. But life stepped in the way of his dreams. So for now, he was an enforcer for one of Painland's notorious street gangs. The twins' other childhood friend, Mellow Yellow, and like Mitchie Terrible, looked every bit the part of a hardened street thug, right out of Central Casting. But I was told Mello, the light-skinned albino with freckles and a dark, menacing stare, was more of a Nepo gangster in the Jamaican underworld, being the second cousin to the area Don and Painland's sadistic kingpin that left a trail of dead bodies in his wake. Everywhere we went in Kingston, from Crossroads to Constant Spring, from Duaney Park to Manor Park, people knew the twins, called out for them, stopped them to talk or just hail them up. For two guys who never had a hit song or an appearance in a major video or stage show, these guys were already stars and seemed to be staples of the Kingston landscape. I would come to find out that before they drove around the city in their brand new second-hand Ford Taurus, they rode around the city on beat-up bicycles. And before that, they walked around the city on worn-out sneakers. Every day since they were kids, these identical twins, dressed in identical outfits, carrying buckets and rags, would leave from their house in Chisholm to Halfway Tree without even spending a dollar on a bus fare. The brothers would wash cars from sunup to sundown until everyone went home and all the businesses had closed. Then the twins would head back into the slums, stopping at the same little ghetto shop every night just to get enough groceries to help feed their mother, brothers, and sister. Twin of Twins fought off despair and depression by always staying in motion. They always kept moving, even on weekends, when they had time off, no matter how tired or hungry or broke. Curly Locks would force his brother on endless walks through Kingston's residential uptown neighborhoods, even if that meant walking miles up into the hills, to gaze in wide wonder at how the other half lived. These sojourns were not meant to incite jealousy or anger or resentment. These walks were merely for inspiration. You see, creative visualization and the use of mental imagery to attain their dreams, well, that wasn't going to be enough to drag them out of the depths of poverty and despair that they inhabited since childhood. The twins didn't want to mentally visualize anything. They wanted to physically see it for themselves, firsthand. See that fresh paint on the newly constructed homes. Smell the flowers from the perfectly manicured gardens. Hear the laughter and love from the families playing in their yards. The more they looked, the more they absorbed, the more they imagined and manifested. They plotted out where they wanted to buy their little parcel of land, how they could manage a down payment, the cost for just enough concrete blocks to construct a temporary home, a place good enough for them to get out of the ghetto, after which they can renovate, build separate homes. On these walks, the young twins decided on the color of their home, the design and material for their roof, what kind of fountain they wanted in their driveway, right down to where their big screen TV would go in the living room. I'd learned from Twin of Twins that having dreams, wanting a better life, it's not nearly enough to make it happen. According to Curly Locks, having plans and the discipline to follow through, well, that's a different story. And the next stop on our journey is where the next chapter begins. There were a few times back in the day that I would drive through Red Hills on my way to country, in order to avoid Kingston's rush hour traffic. But since I was worried about getting lost, I never paid much attention to how beautiful, how palatial some of these homes were, especially in Plantation and Belvedere Heights. Some of the designs look like they came right out of Architectural Digest. This is where Kingston's elite reside. The politicians, the business leaders, diplomats. It's where expats build their dream homes, far away from the noise and clutter and violence of the city. They surround themselves with walls and gates to protect their person and property. The area is patrolled by private security firms with names like Guardsmen, Hawkeye, Marksmen, who employ former soldiers and police to keep ghetto youth like Curly Locks and Two Locks out of these neighborhoods. So I was a little unsure of where we were and why they were taking me there. Two Locks veered onto a small, unpaved, blood-red dirt road, which is how the area earned its name Red Hills, and passed by a newly built Mediterranean-style stone-washed mustard villa, with with a red clay roof. The owner of that home, a businessman just returning from work, waved at the twins as we passed. We drove until the end of the road, onto a messy half-acre property, in a private alcove surrounded by tall cliffs covered in thick shrubbery. The lot was filled with piles of dirt and construction debris, and on the side of the property there stood a small, unpainted one-bedroom concrete house with a makeshift zinc roof and wires running from windows, bridging into nearby power lines.
You see this piece of land here, Henry? We got this from the crumbs of the business.
No way. This place is yours?
The little scrapings. The leftovers.
The leftovers?
Yes, Enrique.
You are flipping joking.
Seen?
This is a freaking dream. Oh my God. This is heavenly, man. You got this scraping up the crumbs of the business?
So just imagine if we were able to get a slice of the cake.
Oh, I'm already imagining. But are we in the same business?
Just imagine what we would achieve.
Just heading towards the Bahamas at the minute before starting our radar vectoring into Miami. It's going to take roughly 40 minutes from this point. You can never tell with air traffic control. It could be a short radar vector's in, or it could be round the houses, but we'll work on 40 minutes from this point.
It was late in the day, and Bigga said he didn't want to meet up at the studio. So I told him to link me at the Deerfield Beach Pier, one of my favorite chill spots. Originally constructed back in the 50s, the rickety boardwalk with its beat-up bait shack was home to the dregs of Deerfield, locally known as the Beer Pier. After being destroyed by Hurricane Donna in 1960, it was rebuilt with concrete pilings, and now juts almost 1,000 feet into the Atlantic, offering unequaled panoramic views of the ocean and the South Florida coastline from Pompano Beach all the way up to Boca Raton. And since the city charges a small fee for fishing and sightseeing, the pier never gets overcrowded, and there's always enough space to carry on a conversation, or just listen to the sound of the waves kissing the pier, and the laughter of beachgoers echoing across the sand. Bigga, what's going on, my brother? What's going on with you, bro? Tell me now. Let's sit down, all right?
Well, things are not good, Henry. Some really scary shit. First of all, my blood sugar has been off the chart. I went to the doc, and they told me I have type 1 diabetes.
Wow, bigger.
I dropped over 50 pounds in yard. My doc said if I didn't come in right then and see him, I could have had a heart attack. I could have dropped dead. This is real serious shit, Henry. It's crazy. I'm not even 21.
Wow, bigger man. You actually look pretty freaking good dropping the weight. But, yo, that's the last thing I was expecting to hear. I didn't think it was so severe. Diabetes, hypertension, holy man. Well, it's a wake-up call. Like you said, you're young, you know? Change in lifestyle, cut down on the Philly cheesesteaks, exercise, stop freaking smoking, right? No more cigarettes, please. You know, you'll be back stronger than ever. It's like I always tell you, man, this business is not a sprint. It's a marathon.
Well, that's what I'm actually trying to tell you. For me, the race is over. I'm hanging up these running shoes. I've been trying to figure out a way to tell you for the past couple weeks, and these last couple days have been really, really rough because I just don't want to hurt you, man. I don't want to let you down. You've done so much for me as a person, as an artist. I mean, being in Jamaica was a revelation for me. Meeting Curly Locks and Two Locks, getting to know people like Harris and Turbulence. And even before all this health bullshit, I was asking myself, do I really deserve a deal compared to these guys down here in Jamaica? Or do I even want one? I've been doing some serious soul searching, and for the first time in my life, I really know who I am. And I've realized that I've been running away far too long. I don't want to be bigger anymore. I just want to be Steve. I hope I'm not letting you down.
Bigger, bro, please, letting me down? You kidding me? Your words just lifted me up. My little boy is all grown up.
Shut the fuck up.
No, man, I'm serious. I'm proud of you. You made a wise decision. It's your only choice. I mean, when I first decided to work with you, Bigga, you really think it was because I wanted her to get a record deal? Or I thought we'd sell a million albums? I mean, yeah, it'd be nice. But I knew the odds. The fact that you even got a record deal to begin with is more than most people even achieve in a lifetime. No, Bigga, it was never about the destination. It was always about the journey. And it was epic, right?
Damn straight.
Up until now, and this is still the beginning. For both of us, whatever you do in life, you'll take this experience with you. It's part of you. Listen, Bigga, as hard as it is to find a hit song as an artist, there's one thing in life even harder. Finding yourself. And I'm glad you finally discovered what I saw all along. You're a star. A big friggin' shining star. And your father really missed out. He really missed out on a great kid. A great youth.
My father didn't miss anything. You've been right here the whole time.
One thing, though. I'm not calling you Steve. You're always gonna be Bigga to me.
Enough respect, Enrique. You can call me Bigga forever. And call me before you head back to Yard, because I know you're going back.
Bigga Star pulled off in his dark green Chevy Blazer. Of course he was blasting his own music from the stereo. As he made his way towards the Intercoastal, heading west into the sunset, that glowing orange orb dipped behind the Everglades, and the music from his truck faded into the dusk. I walked back down to the beach and sat near the shore. The night was slowly descending on Deerfield, and the stars were awakening in the sky one by one. You know, being up in Red Hills the other day with the twins, and seeing their piece of land that they managed to buy with, as Curly described, the crumbs of the business, that was a revelation. It actually reawakened a long-forgotten dream of mine. When I first moved to Kingston and we rented the house up in Armour Heights, I'd usually be the first one up in the morning. And while the rest of the house and most of the city was still asleep, I'd be outside on the rooftop deck in a patio chair awaiting sunrise. Kingston was soft and still, and I was young and naive enough to believe that one day I'd own a house like this in Jamaica. My own little sanctuary. High up in the hills, I'd be the watchman of the city. That was before I woke up, looked around and saw that people like me, the foot soldiers in the business, all we ever got were crumbs. The scraps that fell off the table when the fat cats feasted. But seeing what the twins were able to do with those crumbs, two youth from the ghetto, who never even graduated high school? Well, that got me thinking that they were onto something. It was time to forget about the crumbs, and time to imagine that I had a slice of the cake.
Tell you about black man supremacy. Mr. Rastafari.
RootslandNation.com. Listen to back episodes of the podcast. Stream original music. Check out the latest fashions. RootslandNation.com. Wear your culture.